The natural world is a remarkable teacher for us. We want guidance on life. It's a good place to look. We see the cycles of change born of seasons and days, the coming and going of things in the world around us. And it speaks to us in so many ways of the movement of life, the warmth and the coolness that flow through the room, even in just a space of a few hours. Life is always moving. And so far as we imagine ourselves to be able to somehow step out of that process and fix things in a static way, it's an expression again of the belief, the fantasy that we could somehow be separate from the ongoing movement, the ongoing unfoldment of life. And we can't. We can't. There is, of course, a lot we're called on to let go of in this process of what we call being alive. So many things that move on before perhaps we wish they might have done. And yet, that very movement is part of what allows life the potential to keep expressing something new, something fresh, and the very sense of aliveness itself is bound up with that potentiality. Again, what's precious for us in it is very much expressed in that capacity to re-arise in some form that is fresh, that is new, and that is alive. That which is not alive is not moving. That's pretty much the definition. And in fact, our way of looking at what's moving, if we look at the larger sense of things, really movement is, or what we think is moving, is all relative to our sense of time. You know, to a human being, a mountain looks like it's there forever. But from another scale or perspective, a mountain is something that pops up and disappears. And to an insect, probably a human being looks like it's here forever. We know that we aren't. Something about that movement of aliveness, if we look at it on the scale that we can see it on, can be very uplifting. I was speaking earlier about concrete being fascinating and a few of you chuckled. I think it's probably fair enough to say that it's, you know, a challenge to be fascinated by concrete. I'm not saying that I've succeeded in that particular challenge. But what I find is that if I really look at it carefully, what I think is concrete is not just concrete. And that's something really important if you live, as I imagine many of you do, in a city. Now, I don't live in a city, but there's still ways in which this can happen. You know, for me, living in the countryside in Devon, it feels like it's pretty densely packed compared to where I grew up. Now, compared to living in London, there's a lot of empty space, probably. But one of the practices that I undertook at times when I have lived in London and in other more urban environments was to see where was the aliveness. And not just the human activity, but you know, it's really amazing to find a piece of concrete. And if you look at over a piece of concrete, you'll probably find something somewhere growing in it. It's really fascinating. If you look at a brick wall and you carefully look on it, something's growing on it or in it. If you encounter a road whether made of concrete or asphalt and you look around the edges, what you see is little green shoots starting to slowly poke their tender little noses out through that material that we think of as dead, dry, hard and lifeless. And kind of sort of like some kind of monolithic structure. And it gives me actually great joy to see a blade of grass just slowly popping its way up through a piece of concrete or an asphalt road, and it just kind of, it's soft, it's green, you could squish it easily. But it just goes, And you know, if it's left alone to do that, it will actually crack the concrete or the road. And if you leave a road along, leave a road alone for a little while, there's a place in Wales I go regularly where they recently changed the road, and there's a 100-metre section of road that's no longer in use. It's just a pedestrian walkway now. And what's really amazing is over the course of 10 years I've been going to this place, this road is getting eaten by the grass. And it gives me, again, it's very uplifting. It's like the aliveness breaks through the place where it's hard, dry, apparently lifeless or dead. And this is something that life speaks to us about, the unstoppable aliveness of what's going on, of what's here. Sure, it might show up in different forms. When something is lost, it may not reappear again, but something new seems to show itself. And we have this capacity to tune into that, to actually know, again, as I've said, in different ways we can come to know and understand and be profoundly supported and nourished by our communality with, our non-separateness from, the expressions of life that are all around us. For myself, growing up, as I said, in New Zealand, I found it for much of my early life really hard to feel in any way comfortable in a kind of a human-created environment. It was kind of like, it was always like, ah, I don't like that. It's like somehow human beings aren't nature. We're just, you know, look what we do. Look what we do. And I couldn't easily find at ease, find myself in at ease there. And over the years and in my practice, a conscious process of reflection, of just watching and saying, okay, yeah, but this is what human beings do. This is what human beings create. And it kind of came home to me at one point, I think, I can't remember exactly where I was. I was in America and I encountered a termite mound for the first time. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these things. They're amazing. And it's like this edifice constructed by these little, you know, relatively sort of probably irritating creatures if they were, you know, in your bed or something like that, or in your house, more than irritating probably, termites. But they, and the sense of like, wow, look at these creatures, they made this. How amazing. And then it occurred to me, well, imagine if I walked into a building and thought, wow, look, some creatures made this. Because they did. They really did. Some creatures made this. We think we're not creatures, but we're not acting any different than those creatures. We're not necessarily that much wiser than those creatures a lot of the time. We just got to do what we think we need to do, despite the fact that a lot of times it doesn't always serve us. And it's kind of tragic that that's so. But it's very human. It's human. It's very like what life does. Life does that. And so I find it, again, an interesting practice to just contemplate. And, you know, in one way, one could look at some of those buildings and think, you know, this is the expression of someone's inflated ego saying, here am I can build a bigger building than anyone else built. Another way, it's like, wow, you know, people, creatures, out of stuff that came out of the soil, mostly, made one of those. It's like to see it with different eyes. Something, again, I'm not trying to make some ultimate truth out of that, but it's more like what happens in the heart when we reflect, when we contemplate like that. What I find is something opens up that kind of just allows something in the heart to breathe, to see that, oh yeah, we're doing all of this not that differently than anything else does it. And I've had, you know, various experiences over the years that somehow just touched me in that way. And I'd like to share a few of those, which I'm sure you've had similar experiences in different ways. I remember once doing walking meditation on a retreat when I was in India and seeing a stick, a small stick or twig on the path in front of me. What I thought initially, it must be blowing towards me because it was moving towards me. I was fascinated because I realized as I looked at it that it was going against the wind. I thought, it can't be doing that. How can a stick be moving? It's a little twig about this big, but it was, and I was being careful, you know, walking, paying attention as we do. And then I looked really carefully. I saw there was an ant that was about this big, a stick that was this big, and the ant was dragging the stick into a headwind. as I was walking. And it was quite hard work doing the walking meditation. You know how that is, son. You know, oh, this is tough. You know, from an objective, external perspective, it might not be really that tough when you think about, you know, walking back and forth. Doesn't sound that bad, does it? But we know that it can be hard to do that, to stay within the and to contain the urges that want us to do something else. But just seeing this little creature, it was like, wow, that must be such hard work. Really? You know, it would be like me picking up a 50-foot log and dragging it around. And there's no way I could even do it, let alone it be hard work. And something in that is a sense of, okay, so this is hard, but this is what I'm choosing to do. This is what I need to do in my life at that time, walking meditation. And that is the ant's business. That's what it's doing. But it's like, yeah, it's not just me that has tough things. Ants too. Ants too. It was like hard work. This, you know, you could, if I, when I got close, I couldn't probably even see it now with my eyes that I have now, but then I could get down and really see them carefully, or her or it. And it was, you know, push them. It was hard work every step. So it seemed to me. So maybe it's okay that sometimes things are hard for us. But it's not supposed to be always easy. It's not because we did something wrong. And another time I remember with a robin at Gaia House in Devon, the retreat centre, some of you will know. And this little robin was one that would always come and eat the crumbs on the table. Sometimes we'd eat outside on the picnic tables outside. And so some of the retreatants and the yogis would, you know, try and get it to eat the crumb out of its out of your hand. And I was sitting there trying to, and I was one of them, trying to get this robin to take the crumb out of my hand. And it's like, you know, because it feels so nice if the robin will actually take it out of my hand. I love that, you know. It's such a sweet thing. And one might feel quite okay with it. And yet, because I was been meditating and quite sensitive, I'm generally sensitive, but not entirely sensitive, because what I realised as I was watching it is that that robin really wanted this little crumb of bread. You could see in its eyes, it was like, give me that, that's good food. And it was terrified. It was absolutely terrified to get any closer to this great big mammal that, as far as it knew, might just as well turn it into food as give it a piece of food. And again, it's just really interesting, that moment of just seeing that, and it's not some great perception, of just seeing that and feeling the sense of, oh gosh, yes, aren't there those times when we so want something and at the same time we're so scared about what might happen if we try and get it? Or we're drawn to pursue something that might actually be quite, put us into danger. Don't we know that situation? And for me, again, in that, it's like, oh, you can have this crumb, you know, here, have a piece of bread, you know. I don't need you to take, I didn't need it to take it out of my hand to make me feel, oh, it trusts me, it likes me. You know, it was more like, wow, I don't need that, because it already, we share so much. And those kinds of experiences, again, they, I think they touch us. And certainly my sense of it touches me because of the sharedness, the communality of the experience. When we can see that in another human being, another creature. Sometimes when we can allow ourselves just to even see it in ourselves and recognize, oh wow, how deeply we long for what we long for and how terrified we are of what we're scared of. And we just are. That's how we're made up, it seems. That doesn't mean we have to be bound by that longing or driven or imprisoned by that fear. But those are conditions we need to understand and work with. And to see, how might I wish to live in this world in that way? I was just recently teaching in Massachusetts in America, Insight Meditation Society. And it's a wonderful retreat center and very beautiful, and many people have done a lot of practice there. So a very sort of place I have a lot of love for. And this was just a few days ago I came back from there. And while I was there, as it always is in summer,
there's tons of little creatures there. It's lovely, it's warm, it's comfortable, but there's tons of little creatures there who want to make a meal of your body. Just one little drop at a time. You know, they're not going to do you any serious harm. But it's really interesting and a challenge to just be there and open to the reality that these creatures, mosquitoes and biting flies, they want to bite me, it seems. And so again, there's a contemplation here that's really interesting. It's like, what's happening, and particularly with a mosquito, it's even more touching. If one really looks at what's going on here, here's this tiny little creature. And at least in that part of the world, and similarly here, creatures like that, they're no real danger to us. They might be able to cause us some discomfort or inconvenience and certainly some physical irritation, but they're no danger to us. And so really contemplating the mosquito, sometimes it's like I just allow myself to reflect on what's going on here. It's like actually this creature with mosquitoes, it's the female. It's always the female that's coming. And actually, she's looking for food for her babies. This is how she does that. She doesn't have another way to do that. And she's doing so at the risk of her own life. Because if she comes too close to me, or most human beings, unless they're feeling mindful and quite compassionate, there's a serious risk that this creature, she will die in the endeavor to get this food. And yet she's compelled to seek it. Now, for myself, if I'm mindful, my intention is to remove without harming. Now, if I'm not mindful, I just feel an irritation, my hand is there before I even know it. And it's like, and to stop and just say, I've just killed this creature who is looking for food for her children. And just stop with what that means, what that feels like. Because it's actually as true as any other truth about what's going on here. And for me, what that means is sometimes just to say, okay, yeah, not always, but sometimes, okay, yeah, you can have some. And it's really interesting what happens with that. Because, you know, the sensations in my arm aren't any different, but the experience is completely different. It's like, actually, we can share this. We really can share this. And I was speaking about this very experience or kind of phenomena at the retreat there. And a woman came and said to me, she said, you know, before you gave that talk, I was just moved to allow one of these mosquitoes to take some blood, just to let it. She just felt the sensitivity and the openness and the willingness. She said, yeah, I can do that. And she said, because she didn't flap, normally she gets a really big reaction to them. And so it's quite difficult for her. It's not just a little itchy bite. It's a big hive she gets. She said, okay, I'm just going to do this and see what happens. She said she let it land, take what it wanted, pull out and fly away. And she said, I didn't get the hive. That actually, when the whole thing is allowed to go through, that the actual irritant is part of what happens when you take them out prematurely. At least this is what her experience was. I can't guarantee this for you. I'm not saying you're going to even try and find out. But what is it that happens in us when we treat what is around us as we might wish to be treated? When we imagine other creatures, other expressions of life to be not different and not separate than us? When we feel, when we recognize and understand our co-participation, our not separateness, when we kind of have more of a gut sense of that we are part of something larger, something vast, something ultimately timeless and indestructible, expressing itself as it does, as life in so many forms. When we sense that we have a place in this, that we're part of this, something really different happens for us. We start to release the sense of somehow having got it wrong or being somehow not, that we don't quite fit. You know, it's so painful when we imagine the reason that at times life hurts is because we messed up. or because we're somehow an aberration here. It's not like that. This is the first noble truth, the teaching of the Buddha. In life there are those things that hurt. And it's always like this. It's always been like this. It's not because we've done something wrong. But we need to understand this. We need to forgive life for the fact that it's like this. And to see that that does not somehow make us or place us outside of life, a life that in our fantasy would be always comfortable, always pleasurable, always easy. But it actually weaves us deeply into the web of life in which there is birth and death, in which there is joy and sorrow, in which there is beauty. And there equally, at times, is that which is horrific to encounter. But it's all together. It's all woven together. And what holds it is the deep care we have for life, the deep care we have for what we have opened to so far, and which speaks to us of our capacity to open further, to include it all in our hearts, and in that inclusion, to find our place in it. Mary Oliver writes in The Wild Geese, she says, "You do not have to be good. You do not have to crawl on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. You have only to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you about mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things." You do not have to be good. You have only to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. And when we let the soft animal of our body love what it loves, and we don't filter that loving through the mind of conceiving that imagines and believes that we are separate from others, from creatures, from trees and grasses, this very earth and this world. When we don't separate ourselves from it through believing that way in which our mind works, that place that is ours is evident as natural in our hearts. Our place in the nature, in the family of things. And in that our natural response to life, it seems to me, is that we wish to honour it, we wish to cherish it. This very body, we want to take care of it. But equally, we might share it for the well-being of others. We might use its capacities to serve others. There's a remarkable story of, it always touches me, I like to share it, of Ryokan, who was a Zen monk in the 18th century, and a wonderful poet and mystic, and also known for spending a lot of time playing games with children rather than meditating. But he was once observed on a cold winter's day, after the frost and the sun had come out, taking the lice out of his robe and putting them on a warm sun-facing stone, a rock face, to warm themselves up. It's like, how amazing, that sense, these creatures that live in his clothes and live on his body, and he taking them out and putting them there to sun themselves. And at the end of the day, even more amazingly, seem to be picking them up and putting them back in his robe. And what did he understand in his heart that led him to do that? This kind of funny old monk that he was. He wrote so often in his poetry of the loneliness of living in his hermitage and of just wishing for someone to come and visit, and nobody would. And then when somebody did, how much joy he would have in that. If you're ever moved to look at his poetry, Ryokan, he's beautiful. We share this body anyway. I mean, it's filled with creatures. You know that, don't you? More biology. We are not the only inhabitant of this body. In fact, if it was a democracy, we'd be vastly outvoted on any decisions. I recently read that there are 1,000 bacteria for every single cell in your body that you might call part of your human tissue. There are 10,000 bacteria. 1,000. Sorry, my mind has gone home with that one. It's one or the other. It's a lot. Given that there are thousands of cells.
10 times more bacterial cells than our own.
Okay, so there's different versions of this. There's a lot of bacteria in the body. And we rely on them for our survival. You know, what is it like if we really contemplate that? This body that I feel so much is me and mine, and that is what seems to define my sense of being over here rather than over there. Because my mind can go over there pretty quickly. The body seems to be here, and yet, you know, in the end, those little guys, they're going to get to have it when we're gone. Really, they are. I mean, again, it could be kind of, you know, a little bit gross to contemplate it that way, but I find it liberating, it's freeing, it's uplifting. It's like, oh yeah, of course. And so some of the times they get, you know, they get a bit of it going and we don't feel so well. But you know, if we think about those bacteria in our body, you know, we could equally think about human activity on this planet. Sometimes the planet doesn't feel so well given what goes on. Maybe it's not well at all. And what do we do with that? What do we do with that? We are not apart from this life. And there's something in the heart that learns to rest in that understanding. And there's something in the heart equally that is called to respond to that truth. To see what can we offer to this world? What can we contribute to the well-being of life? Because the way we live, personally, in our communities, and in our nations on this world, the way we live creates the world in which we live. We are not in the environment. We are the environment. I was listening to this wonderful talk recently by John Francis, a remarkable African-American man who took a vow of silence for 17 years and a vow of never using any form of transport that relied on the oil industry and fossil fuels after a massive oil spill in San Francisco. And still, for now 30 years, has been walking only as his way of transport and has walked the length and breadth of that country and well beyond it in that way. And he says, you know, we are the environment. It's a really beautiful teaching. It's like there isn't something over there. We sort of know that. You can't put something somewhere else. Because wherever we put it, at some level eventually it comes back to us. Mm-hmm. We can't put rubbish somewhere else. We're starting to get that. For a little while we can create the illusion that you can put rubbish in a hole in the ground and it's somewhere else. But it keeps coming back towards us. Through the earth, through the air, through the fact that eventually that pile of rubbish gets bigger. That there's a body of plastic bags in the Pacific Oceans that's the size of Texas. It's like, how did we manage that? as human beings. And if we've got something going on in our body, and sometimes we do, and I'm not saying this isn't tragic too, that we think, oh gosh, maybe I'm not going to survive it. Because sometimes we don't. Do we see how this is not different? And how, of course, we would do what we could to care for this body, or the body of someone we were close to, or even the body of someone who we didn't know but we were touched by, because they weren't well, they were ill. Might we not have the same sense for life? Because just as our heart can rest deeply and profoundly in knowing that we are part of it all, so too the vitality of our life can respond to offer what we can in this world. We can't make all the things that are difficult go away. It's not given to us to have the solutions to all the problems, but there's always things we can do that make a difference. And make a difference. I recently made the choice to travel to Sweden to teach a retreat there in May by train, and exchange the 3-hour flight for a 30-hour train journey. And it was really interesting to make that choice, because I knew I was going to physically be impacted by the choice. And it was tiring, and it was at times quite uncomfortable, even though the trains are pretty good for the most part. We even had a sleeper on one section of the journey. But what was really interesting is, even though I was tired and my body was kind of, at the end of it, something in my heart felt really good. Because it was like, this is something I can do, just to reduce the impact that I have. At the moment, this world is really being impacted by a collective unconsciousness about what we do and how we live, just as we ourselves are. Our own well-being is not separate from the well-being of this world. And how do we want to live if that's true? What do we want to do with our lives if that's true? The freedom, the liberation, the end of suffering that we seek is not something that we do in isolation, but together. And the transformation of this world likewise. Because we are in this together, absolutely. So I'm going to stop there, although I could probably keep going for a while. I'd like to just invite you to take a moment to just allow yourself to notice where any or all of that lands for you. And it may be that there are responses or questions. Maybe that there are observations or reflections from your experience that have arisen here. And so if there is anything you'd like to offer, to express or to ask, you're welcome to do so. Somehow these days seem to disappear in a way that I can never fathom, and there's never quite as much time as I would wish at the end. But that seems to be how it is, so I've given up arguing with it. That's just what happens. But there is a little time now, if anyone has any questions or responses. Please.
I've got a question. wonder whether you could explain a little bit about what you said earlier when seeing suffering and it's too much for you to bear, then you said you should expand out so it becomes more bearable, or so you don't have to hold it alone.
Okay.
I didn't quite understand.
Well, I think, you know, it's not so much a formula as actually what happens when we contemplate being part of something larger. It's not that one just, okay, I'll expand. But what we can notice is the tendency to contract in with something that's difficult, the tendency to contract. And if we actually do allow that contraction to soften, to open up, what will be often the case is it becomes more possible to hold what's there. That's at a more microcosmic level, it's more in terms of the human level. I'm not sure I can more usefully explain it except by saying what I've already said. What's important in this, again, is to reflect and contemplate for yourself and see, does this have some meaning? What might that look like for me? I've had many experiences in which this has been shown to be very clear in a way that I can speak about, but I can't tell anyone about. It's a limitation. But you know that expression that says a problem shared is a problem halved? A problem shared with everything is a problem dissolved by infinity. Sorry, divided by infinity. Mm-hmm. When you divide something by infinity, you get zero. Yeah. Now, that's not precise mathematics, but you get the sense of it. Yeah? There's something about that. In the same way that a joy shared, and this isn't... A joy shared is a joy doubled. And when you share it with everything, you actually amplify it to a level that it seems to balance all that which is hard to hold. Now again, this might not make sense from a head point of view, but there's something that's true about it. That's all I can say.
I would be scared that the suffering gets more than, it gets more unbearable. I open myself even
Yeah, more. That's what we're afraid of. Mm-hmm. You have to try it and see. Mm-hmm. The fear and the contraction says, don't let me really even feel it in case it overwhelms me. Mm-hmm. It overwhelms the sense of our smallness. And the ultimate resolution is the releasing of that. But we have to find it each our own way with this.
Follows on from the suffering kind of that you mentioned as well. I don't even know whether it's a question or a comment, but it seems to me that there is a kind of a balance there. The more pain you allow yourself to feel, the more joy you can feel at the same time. It seems as if they grow together, and if you don't allow either, then you're dead emotionally in your heart. And so it's kind of, I don't know, there is something good about the pain too, because it also gives you the capacity to feel joy. I can't say it any better.
I think you say it well. It's what stretches our heart. And, you know, I think it was Oscar Wilde said, hearts were made to be broken.
Yeah.
And
how often can you break them? Quite often, I
think. Well, interestingly, when they're hard and rigid and tight, when it breaks, it feels broken.
Yes.
But as it becomes more pliable, actually, it kind of, what it does, it breaks out of its limitations. That's what actually breaks, is the limitation. Khalil Gibran and the Prophet, he writes... I can remember.
Pain?
Yeah. I'm just trying to download it.
Pain is the breaking shell.
Yeah.
That encloses your understanding.
Thank you. That's the line, yes. Your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. Just as the stone of a fruit must break so that its heart may stand in the sun, so too you must know pain. It's interesting, we're born through pain. It's painful. And that's how life comes forth. Just that simple metaphor. not so much simple, maybe obvious, if we reflect on it. That's not to say that we need to look for more of it, but that part of the healing in relationship is to actually open our hearts to where it is. Mm. And so much of the anxiety that I will be overwhelmed by what's difficult in this world is born of a misunderstanding. Because in fact, when we open to it, we open to our responsivity. And our responding to it is what heals our hearts. Our being able to bring our kindness or care to the place of pain in our own experience, or through action to respond to the situation of another or a situation in the world with whatever resources or capacities we have to contribute to well-being or to the reduction of suffering or to the transformation of that which is unhealthy and unsustainable.
This is a wild guess, but I'm presuming that being really understanding the interconnectedness of all things is not in contradiction with being a true individual.
Indeed. Someone asked me something about this at lunchtime, and we have to understand correctly what we mean by individuality in terms of particularity in the very specific shape or form that something takes. That doesn't mean that it's separate from other things in the same way. And this is again a simple metaphor. I find it speaks to me. I don't know for you, but my hand is really different than my foot. It really is very different. It's a really different thing. You know, it's got all these other different capacities. It's got a different shape. There's a few things in common, digits, but these ones are short and stubby, and these are long and much more functional. Now, they're different, that we could say it's an individual thing, really individual, but is it separate from that? Well, where, if it was separate, could I find... There is no separation between my hand and my foot. There's just a line drawn in my mind that says, this is the foot, that's the leg, that's the torso, this is the arm, and that's the hand. But from the interiority, there's no such thing. And in terms of the well-being, you know... They're both in the same body. Very particular. Shantideva says, you know, just as we can see this hand and this foot, or arm and leg, as the limbs of this body, can we not see all beings as limbs of embodied life? So in the limb, we can have that sense of, yeah, there's something particular here. And there's going to be a particular mixture of qualities of development and limitation that each person, being, or thing manifests. And that particularity fools us into believing that there's somehow something absolutely separate. But given that all those things depended on everything else around them to come into being, that's not so. That's evidently not so. You know, that thing about... an atom a molecule is the smallest unit of something that can exist by itself. Now, if we apply that to beings, what can exist by itself? Well, nothing. So the smallest molecule in that sense is the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Again, my science might not bear stand. I'm not trying to present a PhD paper here. It's more just that kind of understanding is in our scientific knowledge. You're just applying that to the reality of life, which science doesn't necessarily always do.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Can you